Today is Friday, October 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump says he feels fine on Fox News' Hannity show.
I think I'm going to try doing a rally on Saturday night.
Plus, Kyrgyzstan's president offers to resign.
Now, in offering to resign, the president appears to be extending an olive branch to them. But it may do little to solve the deadlock.
And the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded.
The World Food Programme is the world's largest humanitarian organization.
We'll have these stories and more next. In an interview with the Fox News Network's Hannity Show, U.S. President Donald Trump says he's in great shape and wants to resume campaigning.
I think I'm going to try doing a rally on Saturday night. If we have enough time to put it together, but we want to do a rally in Florida, probably in Florida on Saturday night. Might come back and do one in Pennsylvania in the following night.
The president also held a virtual rally on the Rush Limbaugh radio program Friday. Trump's personal physician said that he had completed his COVID-19 therapy. Dr. Sean Conley said he anticipated that the president could safely return to public events Saturday, but did not say if the president had tested negative for the novel coronavirus. The vice presidential debate between Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris highlighted differences between their approaches on foreign policy and America's role in the world. The two candidates debated whether President Donald Trump or Democratic nominee Joe Biden would do a better job addressing challenges by U.S. rival China and its longtime adversary, Iran. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikuswara reports.
The coronavirus has dominated American politics in recent months, but in this week's vice presidential debate, Vice President Mike Pence and his Democratic opponent, Senator Kamala Harris, argued their view of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and China, issues that have had less focus in the campaign so far. Pence highlighted the recent Abraham Accords that normalize Israel's relations with United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. He said the administration subdued Iran by assassinating its chief military strategist, Qasem Soleimani, and defeated ISIS.
President Trump unleashed the American military, and our armed forces destroyed the ISIS caliphate and took down their leader, al-Baghdadi, without one American casualty.
Kamala Harris said America is less safe because of Trump's unilateral approach to foreign policy, citing the administration's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal achieved in 2015 with ally support.
What we have seen with Donald Trump is that he has betrayed our friends and embraced dictators around the world.
The Iran nuclear deal is a key difference between Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden, with Biden promising to return to it immediately if elected. Alex Fatanka is the director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute.
That would put Israel and some of the other U.S. allies in the region, the Persian Gulf region, plus countries like Saudi Arabia. They would then be on the defensive, and that would be a challenge. But I'm not at this point convinced that that would create a rupture in U.S. Israel relations, or for that matter, U.S.-Saudi relations.
Pence slammed Biden for being a cheerleader for communist China. He said the administration wants to improve relations with Beijing, but that Trump will also hold China accountable for the pandemic.
China and the World Health Organization do not play straight with the American people.
Harris accused Trump of hurting American jobs and economy because of his trade war with China. She cited recent global opinion polls by Pew Research that indicated U.S. allies now respect China's Xi Jinping more than they do Donald Trump.
This is where we are today because of a failure of leadership by this administration.
The Pence-Harris debate outlined a difference in foreign policy between Trump's America First doctrine and Biden's multilateral approach. If elected, Biden has promised he would return the U.S. to leadership roles in international organizations like the World Trade Organization and Trans-Pacific Partnership to contain adversaries, including China. Robert Daly is the director of the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the United States.
That, I think, would produce less uncertainty in the U.S.-China relationship. I think the nature of the relationship, fundamentally contentious and adversarial, would be the same in a second Trump term or in a Biden term.
While foreign policy is usually not at the forefront of voters' minds, one important issue this year is standing up for Israel, which matters to a key group of Trump supporters, evangelical Christians who made up about a third of Trump's backers in 2016. Both Trump and Biden have pledged continued support for Israel. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
President Trump fired back at Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer Thursday evening after she accused the president of fomenting political extremism. Reuters' Gloria So has that story.
Earlier today, Attorney General Dana...
After a thwarted attempt to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, U.S. President Donald Trump used the moment to lash out at the governor Thursday night, accusing her of being ungrateful to his administration. 13 people, 7 of which were associated with an anti-government militia group called Wolverine Watchmen, were arrested on charges conspiring to kidnap her ahead of next month's presidential election. At a news conference, Whitmer accused Trump of fomenting political extremism. Trump hit back and accused the governor of having done a, quote, terrible job. His tweet read, "My Justice Department and federal law enforcement announced today that they foiled a dangerous plot against the governor of Michigan. Rather than say thank you, she calls me a white supremacist." Whitmer has been a frequent Trump target for her efforts to enforce social distancing measures. And on Thursday, she slammed Trump's comments at last week's presidential debate when the president deflected an opportunity to condemn white supremacist groups.
"When our leaders meet with, encourage, or fraternize with domestic terrorists, they legitimize their actions, and they are complicit."
Earlier, U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Michigan, Andrew Burge, detailed the botched plot to abduct Whitmer, attack the state Capitol building, and violently overthrow Michigan's government, an operation FBI agents became aware of on social media. Internal U.S. security memos in recent months have warned that violent domestic extremists could pose a threat to election-related targets.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News. Kyrgyzstan's president, Sooronbay Jeenbekov, said on Friday he was ready to resign once a new cabinet is appointed to end the country's power vacuum. The Central Asian nation has been gripped by unrest since opposition supporters seized government buildings on Tuesday. Reuters' Libby Hogan has those details.
He also signed an order dismissing the Prime Minister, Kubadepek Burunov, and his cabinet.
Kyrgyzstan has been gripped by instability since parliamentary elections on Sunday. Government critics and Western monitors said it was tainted by vote buying. The election handed victory to two establishment parties, one of them closely linked to Jeenbekov. That sparked unrest in the former Soviet state, with protesters calling it a stolen election. Now, in offering to resign, the president appears to be extending an olive branch to them, but it may do little to solve the deadlock. It's also prompted nearby Russia to describe Kyrgyzstan's situation as chaos. President Jeenbekov spoke out earlier in the week.
"I'm holding personal talks with various political parties. Dear political leaders, as the president, I am prepared to do everything in my power to find a way out of this political dead end."
At least 11 parties refused to accept Sunday's results. On Tuesday, opposition supporters stormed government buildings. And throughout the week, confusion has continued and scuffles have broken out between rival groups grappling for power. Parliament has failed to reach an agreement on who should take over from ousted ministers. And at least 3 opposition groups have proposed their own candidates for interim prime minister. Kyrgyzstan is the 3rd former Soviet republic this year that has experienced unrest, alongside Belarus and the Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh in Azerbaijan.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. Turkey's backing of Azerbaijan in the conflict with Armenia over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave is coming under increasing scrutiny. Despite international pressure, Turkey is rejecting calls to back an unconditional ceasefire as Ankara steps up its support of Azerbaijan's military goals. Dorian Jones reports.
Azerbaijan is claiming significant gains in Nagorno-Karabakh in its fight to take control of the enclave from Armenian separatists. Turkey's strong military backing of Azerbaijani forces is a critical factor in the conflict, say analysts.
The effectiveness of the Azerbaijan forces has to do with this deepened military cooperation with Turkey that has involved the training of the Azerbaijan forces, that has involved the transfer of know-how, but also the transfer of strategic assets like armed drones.
Ankara's deepening military support of Baku is part of efforts to project its regional influence. But with Azeri and Armenian forces targeting each other's cities and civilian casualties rising, fears of a broadening conflict are growing. Meanwhile, Turkey faces growing international pressure to push for a ceasefire.
We are deeply concerned by the escalation of hostilities. All sides should immediately cease fighting and find a way forward towards a peaceful resolution. And I expect Turkey to use its considerable influence to calm tensions.
Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, wants Turkey to be part of any mediation to end the conflict. Ankara demands Armenia make concessions.
First, Armenia should immediately stop firing and give up the territories it is occupying and should leave these territories. And it should give a mandate with a timeline for this and guarantee Azerbaijan's territorial integrity.
International diplomatic efforts continue in a bid to secure an unconditional ceasefire. Yet there appears to be reluctance by other nations to intervene, say analysts, a factor Turkey's counting on.
The international community looks at its conflict as if it is contained, not likely to destabilize the region, and therefore it probably won't go beyond these rhetorical gestures of calling for ceasefire, but essentially not doing much to compel countries.
Russia, Armenia's close ally, appears poised to stay out of the conflict for now and is among those pushing for a ceasefire. As the fighting goes on, with no end in sight. Doreen Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
This is Science in a Minute.
The 2020 winners of the Nobel Prizes in Science were announced over the past week. This year's Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was awarded to Harvey Alter, Michael Houghton, and Charles Rice for identifying the blood-borne hepatitis C virus, which could lead to cirrhosis and cancer of the liver. The Nobel Prize in Physics went to Roger Penrose for proving that the formation of black holes is a result of the general theory of relativity, and Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Ghez for discovering a supermassive compact object at the center of our galaxy. And the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna for discovering the CRISPR-Cas9 genetic scissors. With this tool, scientists can precisely alter the DNA of animals, plants, and microorganisms. The Nobel laureates will receive their prizes in a ceremony that will be held in Sweden on December 10th. I'm VOA's Rick Bantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The world is grappling with over 36.5 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus, about 1.1 million deaths, and nearly 25.5 million recoveries. China says it's now joining the COVID-19 vaccine alliance known as COVAX. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma takes things from here.
Initially, China didn't want to join the alliance, missing the September deadline. Now the foreign ministry says officials have signed an agreement with Gavi, the co-leader of the initiative. The terms of the agreement and how China will contribute are not yet clear. An early problem the alliance faced was that many richer countries directly negotiated their own deals with pharmaceutical companies, and some declined to join. Now China says it's joining to ensure equitable distribution of vaccines, especially to developing nations. Officials say they hope more capable countries will also join and support the initiative. Xi Jinping previously said that China would make the vaccine a global public good. COVAX plans to buy 2 billion doses of a vaccine by the end of 2021, although it remains unknown whether the successful vaccine will require one or two doses. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Sunday marks the United Nations annual observance of the International Day of the Girl Child. VOA's Salem Solomon spoke with Ilwad Elman, who, along with her mother, Fartoon Adan, received the Aurora Prize for Awakening Humanity for their efforts in providing services to communities affected by the conflict in Somalia. In an excerpt from their interview, Elman describes her work at the Elman Peace and Human Rights Center in Somalia to help women and girls affected by gender-based violence. She explains the beginning of creating a rape crisis center.
We saw that the human suffering of women and girls was so tolerated, was so normalized, that it was an open secret in society. Sexual violence was so rampant, particularly in 2010, where there was a massive humanitarian crisis, and 350,000 people died. And from all the regions of Somalia, everyone was flocking to Mogadishu for humanitarian aid. So you have mostly women with children in IDP camps, and you have military vehicles parked outside, raping women left and right. And there weren't any service centers to support the victims. So that's how our first rape crisis center started.
How young were the victims that you were helping? And then what kind of structure was there for you? I mean, it seems like there was a lot of obstacles and also taboo associated with all of that. And so if you can give me an example.
There was so much taboo to the point that the president at the time even released a press statement saying that rape does not happen in Somalia. Any organization speaking about this is bringing shame to the country. Our staff were arrested, harassed. Our centers were shut down. This was just a mere 10 years ago. There was no profile of what a survivor of sexual violence looked like in Somalia then. From a 70-year-old woman to a 2-year-old child. Complete impunity. And I feel like of all the work that we've done, whether it's a piece of security, gender-based violence, human rights, education, the one sector that I can actually visibly see change is in this space, gender-based violence. We still have so far to go. But we went from a place where you couldn't even talk about it, where there were no services available at all, to now having multiple service providers, where we have from a surge of 11% women in political participation to 24%, where we had the first Minister of Women and Human Rights, where we had this first sexual offenses bill being debated, where we had a conversation that actually acknowledges that this is happening in the country, and now trying to figure out what to do about it, as opposed to denying it. So that is tremendous progress.
But we've seen also incidents where action was also taken, step back with legislation not really addressing it. Yeah.
So the very sexual offenses bill that I'm celebrating from 2018 was just a month ago recalled and changed into the intercourse bill, where the sexual offenses bill was trying to persecute rapists and prevent it. The sexual intercourse bill is essentially legalizing sexual violence and legalizing child marriage. It is a major setback, but I feel like we can't move forward unless we recognize where we came from. We're talking about a legal framework right now. Before, we were talking about the same woman being served at our centers 3 times in a row. The same person, because we keep sending them back to the same environment that's not any more enabling, not any more progressive, not any more safer. But now we're talking about governing this. So we still have a very long way to go.
That was Ilwat Elman, who along with her mother is the recipient of the Aurora Prize. She was speaking to VOA's Salem Solomon. A flotilla of tourist boats, fishing vessels, and yachts is conducting a pioneering survey of Australia's Great Barrier Reef. Phil Mercer reports that conservationists have recruited more than 30 boats to help examine up to 150 ecologically significant reefs over the next 10 weeks.
The Great Barrier Reef is so vast that as much as 40% of this underwater paradise has never been surveyed. A fleet of private boats has begun inspecting critical parts of Australia's greatest natural treasure to help establish the impact of climate change, pollution, and other threats. The project, coordinated by citizens of the Great Barrier Reef, aims to capture large-scale reconnaissance data. Andy Ridley is the organisation's chief executive.
The Great Reef Census involves a whole load of organisations who work on the reef, from tourism operators to super yacht owners to research stations, universities. There's 4 universities involved, including University of Queensland and James Cook University. And we've had some amazing support from funders such as the Great Barrier Reef Foundation. But it's a really massive collective community effort.
Snorkelers and recreational divers will take photographs at specified sites on the reef every 10 metres. The images will be available online for analysis by so-called citizen scientists around the world. Peter Mumby, a professor at the University of Queensland School of Biological Sciences, says the data will be invaluable.
What we're hoping to achieve with the help of the public is to find those reefs that are most important at driving the recovery of the barrier reef to the series of bleaching events that it has experienced in recent years.
Large areas of the Great Barrier Reef have been degraded in recent years by severe bleaching or loss of the algae that corals host that give them their vibrant colour and much of their energy. It's caused by warmer ocean temperatures, and scientists say it's made worse by climate change. The reef stretches for 2,300 kilometres off northeastern Australia. It's about the size of Japan and is the world's largest coral system. The World Heritage listed area is home to an array of marine creatures, including 600 types of coral and more than 100 species of jellyfish. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The United Nations Food Agency, the World Food Programme, or WFP, won the Nobel Prize for Peace on Friday for its efforts to combat hunger and improve conditions for peace in conflict-afflicted areas. The chair of the Nobel Committee explains why.
The World Food Programme is the world's largest humanitarian organisation addressing hunger and promoting food security. Last year, the WFP provided assistance to close to 1 million people in 88 countries who are victims of acute food insecurity and hunger. In 2015, eradicating hunger was adopted as one of UN's sustainable development goals.
Some 135 million people suffered from acute hunger in 2019. That's the highest number in recent years. The WFP attributes the increase to war and armed conflict. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is offering up to $15 million for information leading to the disruption of key financial mechanisms of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Working particularly through its Quds Force, the IRGC, as it is called, is the chief Iranian institution directing and carrying out the regime's global terrorist campaign. The mechanisms include, among others, financial institutions facilitating IRGC transactions, front companies tied to the IRGC, and IRGC donors or financial facilitators. One such facilitator is financier and senior IRGC leader Abdul Reza Sholei, a commander in the IRGC Quds Force based in Sana'a, Yemen. Born in Iran circa 1957, he is also known as Haji Youssef. At a press conference, Special Representative for Iran Brian Hook noted that Sholei has a long history of attacks against Americans and our allies globally.
He planned multiple assassinations of coalition forces in Iraq, provided weapons and explosives to violent Shia extremist groups, and planned the January 20th, 2007 attack in Karbala that killed five American soldiers and wounded three others.
In 2011, Sholei directed a plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Adel Al-Jubeir, at a restaurant in Washington.
Had this scheme succeeded, as many as 200 innocent civilians in the United States could have been killed.
Special Representative Hook said that given Sholei's track record of terrorism and destabilization in Iraq, the United States remains gravely concerned by his presence in Yemen and potential role in providing advanced weaponry of the kind we have interdicted to the Houthis.
Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If you have information about Abdul Reza Sholai, please contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or email info@rewardsforjustice.net. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.